red. Sounds like the lightamine diodes might really be infrared or ultraviolet. I'm going to guess infrared. And they're lighting up the phosphor.
It's all ultraviolet.
Okay, so it's ultraviolet fed, but the phosphor itself, how close does phosphor come to true sunlight lighting, if you know what I mean? I can buy a, I forget what it's called now, true lighting fluorescent tube, which is a little bit more expensive and doesn't last quite as long, but it's a lot more pleasant to look at. I'm guessing the new light-emitting diodes don't quite come up to that standard. Is that true, Eric?
Alright, the SunGlow Natural fluorescent lamps are actually a mixture of different kinds of phosphor. And if you were to look at it on a spectroscope, you'll find that it's pretty broadband. And it's centered around the green, so to speak. Where your eyes are the most sensitive, by the way. So your eyes work the least there. The LED is around 6,000, 6,200 degrees. But the spectrum output is very narrow. It's really in the blue region. And that's why it hits people's eyes.
Okay, with 20/20 hindsight, couldn't they have put the same kind of phosphor inside of those light emitting diodes that I buy in those true color fluorescent tubes? Over to you, Eric.
Alright, right now I can get you, actually take three LEDs to give you a really broad spectrum when you mix them together. It'll be pretty close to sunlight. When we talk about TV screens and that kind of stuff, those are the wavelengths we're talking about. And they tend to be, even in the TV sets, they still tend to be narrow. I think they run from like, 640 to 680 or 690 before you get into the next hue of color. But they're narrow lines. They're not broadband lines per se. If you look at a CIE chart for each one of the frequencies of them, they look like a 2T pulse in my head. But the amount of spectrum they provide is real narrow. So it means that for the high amount of light output that they provide, there's a lot of energy in a single frequency or a very small group of frequencies. And the point of the matter is, let me get it up. There were these studies done in terms of what makes you see more clearly out on the road. It just so happens that very narrow band spectrum in the upper region, which make your eyeballs work really hard, gives you the most visibility.
Gee, that seems hard to believe, Eric. Had they made the light-emitting diodes three different kinds of diodes inside of each lighting fixture, maybe there's a total of 30 light-emitting diodes in there, so 10 of them are each of the three different kinds, so that now you're coming closer to true daylight lighting, where you don't get people's eyes hurting. I'm having trouble believing that doesn't give you greater overall visual acuity for the average driver, and therefore, although it's a little bit more expensive, the fact that you're going to have a smaller number of accidents on the road because people's eyes are operating more like they do at high noon, I'd like to believe that even with the extra cost and maybe a little bit of extra power dissipation, that that's a very desirable way to go. Did they cut it a little bit too close to the bone on this one with efficiency and what they think is visual acuity? And maybe those were not objectively chosen human beings for that test. KE2EJ, K2RIW. Not everybody has perfect vision, for instance.
No, I agree with you, but there's a couple things that you're leaving out of this. One is you'd have to argue with all the, with several universities that did the study. The one element that's missing from your argument is contrast ratio. During the day, when you have God's light lighting up everything, the contrast ratios you're dealing with in terms of visual acuity and being able to see edges, so to speak, is way different than in the nighttime environment. And their studies are based solely on the nighttime environment and what works. And these are real world case test that they did the study with. And it turns out, because they do have a white LED, what we call a white LED, or a 6,000 degree LED, is a mixture of phosphors. But you got to remember that the emitter is a source of energy, which in this case is UV. And the efficiencies of the various different phosphors, as well as you try to blend them together, they're not the same. So you wind up with, you know, not quite enough red, not quite enough green, when you've got a lot more blue. So that's why, like, displays and these big bulletin boards and everything that you see are composed of red, green, and blue elements to create the whole spectrum of colors. There's other ways of doing it, but you can control the intensity of the red, you can control the intensity of the green, you can control the intensity of the blue, and, you know, mix and match them to create the output light that you're trying to create. It's my belief, Eric, that some of the high-class TV displays have four primary colors, red, green, blue, and yellow. Roughly what advantage you get out of those yellow LEDs that are on the high-class displays? Does that give you a higher...
Repeater, timeout.
Does that give you higher fidelity of flesh tones, which is a difficult chrominance to produce? Well, first of all, there's one company that owns the rights to that. They have the intellectual property, and that's sharp. This does actually give you a better sense of continuous chromosity, red to blue. Think of it as a really smooth rainbow, so to speak. Yes, it does help in the green. The yellow is a green component, and, you know, flesh tones are green. But optically, it provides a more linear chain from one place to the other, whereas electronically, depending upon the systems that we're using to transmit that information from, you wind up having different gammas at different parts of the spectrum, because we only do things with so much resolution. Adding that yellow element and matrixing it out from the red, green, and blue gives you a way to optically kind of smooth that rainbow, so to speak, you follow? I sure do. The majority of us who are not colorblind have cones in our fovea, in our macular area of the center of our retina, which are red, green, and blue cones. Low in sensitivity, but they do a beautiful job of getting color, whereas the rods out of the perimeter of our vision have much higher sensitivity, but they only see in black and white. A small percentage of the population has red, green, blue, and yellow cones in their eye. I wonder if Mother Nature decided that those people have a survival advantage. What's your guess, Eric? K3J, K2RW.
K2RW, K3J.
Well, if you go look at the way Darwin thought about how we evolved, if you go back in time, the yellow sensors there may have provided the human an advantage in terms of finding food. So the fact that it is not that common anymore means that it's evolving, and the human being, I guess, no longer needs it if you want to go with that kind of thing. Okay. It sounds to me like the light-emitting diodes that are being installed now, they're saving a lot of energy compared to sodium. And maybe the dark sky phenomena, the way the shielding and the shades occurs, and the way the directivity of the light-emitting diodes themselves occurs, maybe there's a slight advantage there. But if people are complaining that it hurts their eyes and gives them a headache, and for some of those people that are going to be driving a large number of hours per day, in fact, we should have a conversation with Rick teaching UPS on this one, because he's driving through all kinds of areas of the United States. And if there's five different kinds of lighting, I'll bet you he sees all of them. He probably has an opinion as to which ones really are working well.
a little bit afraid that the light emitting diodes are installing right now. Maybe we should hope that they don't last forever, don't have an infinite life.
They're right about 20 years.
Okay. So would you think we're going to be stuck with them for 20 years, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, well, there's a company called American Lighting Systems that a lot of the municipalities are buying from, as opposed to a number of the Chinese companies. The weakest link in a lot of these things is going to be the power supply. And you think of the environment that the lamp has to be in, whereas like an old cobra head is basically a ballast, a photocell detector to turn it on and off, and the bulb. Usually it's at 220. Real simple. The LED is not quite so simple, especially the bigger ones that require a higher amperage in terms of power supply. Oh, the one thing I wanted to mention is that, I'm going to drop. When it comes to municipality, there are a lot of low-pressure sodium lights. Those are the things that look like really deep orange, and those things pollute the sky like you wouldn't believe. But the interesting aspect of it, the low-pressure sodium lights draw less juice than the LEDs do. So they're not going to disappear as fast as the high-pressure sodium lights, so bear that in mind in terms of the optical stuff. But the like the environment down in Florida, they have the problem of insects that nest inside the housing, so the housing has to be sealed. Now, when you have a big power supply like that, you need to get rid of the heat, which means you have to vent it or do something magical or do something expensive, like take a heat transfer tube and make that go outside the cage so it can dissipate the heat. So there are other issues. K2RIW, K2J.
Yeah, to suck air in there to cool off that power supply is definitely not the way to go. It's going to be sucking in salt spray, dust, bugs, and everything. So it's got to be a heat pipe-like thing, or a fancy heat sink. In the case of compact fluorescent lights, when they were first advocated, we were giving numbers for life that were huge, many, many thousands of hours. And maybe the bulb could last that long, but the power supply did not. In the case of these light-emitting diodes, I'm guessing they're running on 220 volts or 240 volts. And that's got to be cut down to something that the light-emitting diodes themselves, I'm guessing each individual light-emitting diode was something like 3 volts, and there's a whole bunch of them in series. And is that coming anywhere near the right voltage? And it's a constant current regulator, I'm sure you're feeding them with, because on a hot versus a cold day, the voltage drop across the light-emitting diode is quite hugely different. So the reliability of that power supply and its heat sinking could be a big factor. So roughly how many volts are each of those light emitting diodes, and what's your guess as to how many are being put in series? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Well, the Chinese do it different than the Americans do. The Americans have a little more, they put a little more intelligence behind what they did. Typically, most of the two different ranges of light source supplies. One's 12 volts, and the other, you'll find them at both 24 and 48 volts. What the Americans do is they'll take a string of 3 or 4 LEDs and put them in series and make up the 12 volts. And they'll make rows that are fed individually. Whereas the Chinese might, if you look at the big 100-watt high-power, big square, they look yellow thing. Those diodes are literally in series with one another. And they do it in quadrants, so when they get a failure of a diode, you lose a whole quadrant, which is not really acceptable. But that's just the reality of the different thinking between the engineers there and the engineers here. The company that provides the stuff for most of them is Cree. They're one of the biggest LED manufacturers, and they have their papers on the recommended procedures, which seems like our guys kind of listen to and the foreigners don't. So, anyway, the experience down in Florida, I mean, we think of diodes, we can use them as temperature sensors. The junction resistance changes according to its operating temperature, its ambient temperature, starting them up, so on and so forth. Eliminated drop. So the power supplies definitely have to be current limited, and they have to be able to maintain constant current. You know, there need to be constant current supplies. Well, your semiconductor products usually don't have an issue with the heat, but the capacitors are the weakest link, and those are the things, and I've seen them blow up left and right simply because they get too hot. K2RIW, K2EJ.
So these lighting fixtures that are being installed on our highways now, I think you're saying they're being advertised as if they're going to last for 20 years. There's good reason to believe that the heat sinking of the light-emitting diodes and the heat sinking of the power supply is such that you may get a power supply into a light-emitting diode failure quite a bit easier, quite a bit sooner than 20 years. That might be the possibility, unless they've done an extremely good extended life testing like they do for the Department of Defense. I wonder how much real testing they did, Eric. You know, cyclic temperature and salt spray and so on. Over to you, K2RIW. K2RIW, K2J. Well, I can show you a couple of Chinese ones I have. And I can show you an American one. At least the American one, the top half or the bottom half, depending upon the model, are actually the heat sink for the switching transistors. But the one thing that nobody seems to be taking into consideration, I know that the Chinese use aluminum capacitors made in China, and we put a thermistor inside a head without turning it on, and at the height of the day, the ambient temperature inside the head from the sun beating on it gets upwards of 140 degrees Fahrenheit, which is like really nasty to, you know, liquid electrolytes. So the further south you go, the more failures you're going to see. The further north you go, the less failures you're going to see. But you're going to see failures whether you like it or not.
That's your ATG with a query.
And I bet you they were not enthusiastic enough to put in ceramic capacitors. Go ahead there, Dave.
Yeah, just a quick question. When they talk about, you know, the LEDs and the power supplies and all this stuff, and, you know, they have these tremendously long lifespans, you know, the LEDs are going to last 100,000 hours or whatever it is, you know, whatever the number is. How do they get to those numbers? I mean, if you say something is going to last for X number of hours, you would think that they've already tested it for X number of hours, but that would be impossible because, you know, 10,000 hours is so many years. So how do they actually come up with these lifespan figures?
You want to answer that with the accelerated testing?
Yeah, there's a MIL-E 5400 or something like that is the standard Department of Defense test for accelerated life test. It's where you operate the electronics in a chamber at extendedly high temperatures. In other words, I believe every time you raise the operating temperature of a piece of solid-state electronics 10 degrees centigrade, the life is cut in half. Rough numbers like that. So you can choose the right kind of temperature and cycle between high and low temperatures and apply certain rates of change of temperature and salt spray and all kinds of things. You can, in a week, on a MIL-E 5400 test, I think it is, in 1 week, you can create 10 or 20 years of equivalent life testing. And I think the correlation between the extended life test and the real world on mil-spec hardware, I believe it's awful good. You maybe have more acquaintance with this than I do, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW, particularly for your broadcast-type equipment. I bet you have an equivalent accelerated life test.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, believe it or not, most of the time the manufacturers don't. What they do is they figure the life cycle of a product is maybe, you know, 10 or 15 years. Like the transmitters that I have here now are no longer supported. That's what keeps me busy. Actually, it's beginning to become hard to get some of the parts that you need because there's no longer a large demand for them. The semiconductor manufacturers don't want to make them anymore. And either you modify it or you go and buy the new latest and greatest. As far as LED accelerated testing goes, there's a couple of different theories out there, because there's the normal stuff which deals with the semiconductor aspect of it, but there's this accelerated testing which they do for the phosphors. They also do it in CRTs, by the way, and basically what they do is they will make a test jig in terms of the phosphor, test LED, so to speak, that has three emitters in it. So it produces three times the amount of photons that are hitting the phosphor, and they also raise the temperature, and they do some weird stuff like that. So, K2RW, K2J.
Yeah, it was Dave that asked the original question. So, by the time you raise the temperature of the testing, cycle through high and low temperatures, some number of hours on each dwell time at each temperature, add salt spray, shake, rattle, and roll, because you know darn well that that's a Cobra head on a windy day is going to have all kinds of vibration, and occasionally it's going to sing. So to do a real thorough extended life test, it's mechanical, temperature, salt spray, and bring in some acid. I don't know what else to do, but there's ways that in 1 or 2 weeks you can put 10 or 20 years of life onto a piece of
repeater. Time out.
You can put 10 or 20 years of life onto a piece of electronics. Over to you, Dave.
Okay, I understand what you're telling me. However, where is the control? So in other words, they're doing this testing, and they're coming up with a time frame. They're coming up with a number, but how do they, you know, again, is there a control? How do they... So it's an estimate, basically, what you're telling me. It may not actually be realistic. You follow what I'm saying? There's no control.
To a degree, there is a control, Dave. That Mili 5400 test has been around since a little bit after World War II. It's got a lot of history. So you can feed back and find out, hey, on this kind of electronics, I predicted it's going to last for 10 years, and it really lasted for 9.3 years. And there's ways you can modify the test, and there is confirmation. They've been using these extended life tests for Department of Defense hardware for many decades. It's got a lot of history. Therefore, for certain kinds of electronics, it's very good at the prediction. Now, if you decide to use a very inexpensive brand X tantalum capacitors instead of mil spec capacitors, and you think that you're going to get the same amount of life out of them, because those kinds of capacitors have got other failure modes, like exploding, particularly if they're put in backwards. There's ways you can fox the test and get yourself in trouble, but if you follow all the rules, I think the history is awfully good between the prediction and the reality. Over to you, Dave.
Okay, yeah, that's what I was looking for. So in other words, they do the testing, and then they actually keep track of things in reality in real time and see what happens down the road, and they compare their notes. So it's been tweaked over X number of decades, you know, that they've been doing it. Okay, very good. I appreciate that explanation. And 2ABJ.
Yeah, when it comes to Department of Defense hardware that's going to go on a military airplane, or even tougher than that, is space qualified. And in order to have something space qualified, where under certain conditions the amount of shake, rattle, and roll it gets during launch is really fierce, and the temperature extremes, if it's a satellite going around the Earth every 90 minutes, it's making a complete orbit, where on the dark side of the Earth, it maybe is being exposed to numbers like 30 degrees Kelvin, and on the bright side of the Earth, it's being exposed to 200 degrees Kelvin. You can have some ridiculous temperature extremes, depending on what kind of foil is wrapped around your electronics. So the right kind of foil can make a huge difference on the temperatures, and there are a number of satellites that have active temperature controls. They have the equivalent. Let me drop it. they have the equivalent of very highly reflective Venetian blinds. And depending on where you are in the orbit, those Venetian blinds are opening and closing. And there's heat pipes and the thermal inertia devices inside and whatever. There's all kinds of, if you know you're going to be bathed in some real cold temperature, but you're only going to be there for 45 minutes. So if there's enough thermal mass inside that satellite with enough insulation, you can keep the temperatures pretty smooth. If there was a nuclear power supply like you've got on Voyager, you can be directing some of the waste heat of the nuclear power supply to the electronics that you want to keep warm. Let me drop. But not only a very small percentage of the satellites are nuclear powered. Very expensive. You only do that when you're going to a place where solar cells can't hack it. When you're 12 billion miles away, three times the distance of Pluto, there aren't enough solar cells in the world out there to give you enough power. It has to be a nuclear power supply. But the amount of plutonium we've got to make those nuclear power supplies is now at a real premium. We're going to be hearing from some of that from Paul. I think it's time to go over to the space report. Let me drop. I was in a library earlier this week, Paul, and the May issue of Sky and Telescope. It's got a beautiful 4 or 5 page article with great photography and graphs and whatever of the Rosetta satellite, which met up with that 67P, and those two German names added to it. This particular asteroid, it met up with it and made all kinds of measurements as to what it consists of, what is the oxygen 14, oxygen 12 ratio, how old does it appear to be, what is its previous origin, where's the mass center. It really is two chunks of material that came together. What happened to the fillet, the little satellite that sent down, lots of good information in the May issue. Issue that's just coming out, so to speak, of Sky and Telescope. I didn't get a chance to see the latest issue of Astronomy Magazine. And we also had a beautiful launch this week you're going to be telling us about. WS2N, the space report number 445, K2RIW in the TechNet. You've got it, Paul.
This is WS2N, and very good, you said 245. The launch you're talking about went off Thursday. I did get a chance to see it launch live because it was 6:27 Thursday evening. So we saw that was good time. Went off exactly on time. So it launched from Launch Complex 39A, and it's the Falcon 9 full thrust rocket that went up, which is 9 engines, producing what I think 1.7 million pounds of thrust, I think they're up to. He's had different iterations. This is the third or fourth. He's got one more to do. He'll upgrade again one more time. And that will be it on the Falcon 9. But the had this booster launched last year, a little over a year ago, and at the time it sent a Dragon up to the International Space Station. Got a cargo mission. Let me drop it. And what he wanted to do is prove that he could land that booster. Roughly 150-foot tall booster, 12-foot diameter, onto a drone. I tried it quite a few times. It hit the booster, hit the barge, and crashed. The earlier ones, trying to see how it would work without a barge out there. you know, test the rocket. Time went on, he got better and better at this. And that was the first time he was able to land a booster onto a barge, and it happened to be an NASA flight, which I was glad. Most of his flights, he's flying privately, you know, for private satellite companies like SES. So now that one came floating back on this barge vertically all the way back to Florida. And then they sent it to McGregor, Texas. That's their testing facility. And retested everything to make sure the engines were right. And chose that one out of the, right now there's eight boosters that he successfully has brought back. Three that landed on land and five on underwater. Actually, one more now. So it's what happened with this one. Drop it. Even so, it's long before it's the first reuse of the booster. Elon Musk's goal from the beginning is to have reuse of almost everything to drive the cost down. Figures it cost $52 million to shoot one of these things up in the air. And if you could just refuel it for $200,000 or $300,000, that would be a lot less expensive. Of course, it's not down to that number yet. He's got a lot of testing and the turnaround time. He actually spent about 4 months working on this rocket, although it's been a year since it flew. So now it's the first time one flew for a second time, and it put an SES-10 satellite into geosynchronous orbit. SES signed a contract with them. They got a percentage or two, I think it was probably around 10%. The numbers aren't really out there, but I think probably around 10%. And he was getting $6.2 million off on the flight. But it did land successfully on the same ship. The name of the ship is, Of Course I Still Love You. He's got two of these barges, one in the Pacific Ocean and this one in the Atlantic Ocean. He's already succeeded in the Pacific Ocean once. This was a bit of history. Elon Musk thought so much that at the end of the flight, made a statement. If you were watching the SpaceX webcast, and at the end he got on and made a statement talking about what his team has accomplished, and you know, to him, this is a big deal. This is what he's been pushing since 2002 or so, when he first got involved with space. SpaceX and reusability, driving the cost down. So now he's got future plans. For a long time, he's been planning on launching what's called the Falcon Heavy. It consists of three of these core boosters, these 12-foot diameter boosters, bolted together on a launch pad, in this case Launch Complex 39A, and plans on launching it into orbit. And he plans on getting probably at least around 5.5 million pounds of thrust out of this three rocket boosters. Originally planned on doing it around 2013, from what I've been reading. It's a lot more was involved than he thought, and he had to do a lot of work on the center core, restructure it, the kind of loads that are involved in doing something like this. But the two outer cores, now he can just use regular boosters. In fact, he's going to use, I believe, on the next flight, probably maybe 3 or 4 months from now, he plans on launching the Falcon Heavy. Two of those boosters are...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Two of those boosters are probably going to be reused boosters. Again, drive the cost down. Again, he's going to to bring those back down to land in Florida. The two boosters, and the third one, he plans on landing on a barge out in the Atlantic Ocean. So, not happy with wasting any parts of the spacecraft or Gold Rocket assembly. He already brings back the Dragon spacecraft that goes up to the International Space Station. Brings back thousands of pounds of science equipment every time that goes up. And on this flight, he also had, this is the first flight that he tried to do this, he wanted to bring back the fairing. Now, the fairing encapsulates, in this case, with the SES-10 satellite that was going to geosynchronous orbit, a very large satellite. So he has a 5.2 meter, but roughly a 5 meter diameter fairing on top, and it's about 45 feet tall, which is large. And I put diagrams of it. If you took a city bus, not a city bus, but a school bus, regular big school bus, you could fit it in inside this fairing standing up. So fairing itself is worth about $6 million. So what he did is he put little thrusters on the fairing and he had parachutes. And from what I understand, he covered, there's two pieces. He recovered one. Possibility he might have gotten both, but I don't know yet.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Somebody also, his original plans were not to bring back the second stage. Well, not the original plans. The original plans was to bring back the second stage, but he gave that up many years ago. Now he's starting to think about it again, because as it is, most of the company, that second stage, after pushing the satellite into orbit, fires little thruster rockets and deorbits and usually goes, let's say, the Indian Ocean or something like that. So it's all waiting. He's got plans on eventually trying to bring that back. It's a long shot, he thinks, but, somewhere down the road he might be able to accomplish bringing back the second stage as well. So the only thing that would be lost would be the trunk. I mean, the Dragon would come back, the fairings would come back. If you could ever get the second stage to come back, that would be great. Maybe, quite a few years from now, with heat shields and everything, he's got planned on putting on the second stage with parachutes. And of course, he's already bringing back the boosters. The only thing that would not return would be the trunk. Let me drop it. The other main news for the week was another spacewalk by two American astronauts, Shane Kimbrough and Janet Janet Woodson. She now set the record for one spacewalk. It's her eighth lifetime CBA. They did a heck of a job rewiring the PMA-3. PMA-3 is the pressure mating adapter 3, which was originally attached to the Tranquility node. And last week's spacewalk, a week or so, preparing in case that pressure mating adapter. And then following that, they had a robotic transfer that Houston did with the Canadian robot arm, and actually transferred that piece to a new location on the space-facing Tranquility node. And that will give them their second docking adapter for visiting crewed spacecraft within a year or so. I saw they were up there, I think they did like a 7-hour EVA. And they had to rewire it, plug cables into the PMA for heat, future data connection. Spacecraft that will eventually dock with it. But in the process of doing it, they will schedule to install micromedia thermal blankets to the port that was left open. And there were four pieces that had to be installed, and one of the pieces got lost in space and floated away. But within that 2.5 hours after, Mission Control came up with a solution that, because of last week's EVA, you know, the previous EVA, they had taken a similar type of blanket, a different size, but a similar type of equipment had stored it into the Quest Lab, you know, where you are. That's where they see you. Took that cover and installed it onto the blank case. And there's one more, but we're gonna hold off on that. Back to you, Dick. This is WS2N for the Space Net Report.
One of the things you just said, Paul, that I haven't heard before was that one of the spacecraft that went to the International Space Station, I had the impression that those cargo ships all bring up cargo but burn up on return. And I guess you're saying that some of those spaceships have come back to Earth without burning up to bring actual pieces of hardware back. That's something that I hadn't properly heard before, and didn't realize what's going on. Give me a few more words on that one, Paul. WS2N, K2LAW.
All the Dragon spacecraft that go up to the International Space Station launched by SpaceX, and they, you know, they launch probably almost 30 different rockets since they've been in business. Out of the 30, 10 have gone up to the space station. Those 10 are flown by, you know, they're called the Dragon space vehicle, cargo vehicle. And they bring up, you know, 6,000 pounds of material, space science equipment. But on the way back, they also bring stuff back. There's plenty of hardware, science hardware, that has to be returned to Earth. Experiments, big refrigerators and freezers that have science equipment, DNA, whatever they're doing up there, have to be returned. And some of these things weigh thousands of pounds. For instance, they want to bring back a heavy space suit a while back. Did that because they wanted to find out what the problem was and had leaks in it. So this is the stuff that they bring back. It comes back, it's got a heat shield, and this Dragon has three parachutes open up, and they land a couple hundred miles off the coast of California. And then from there, they bring them in, and they go to their very happy scientists. Future, they plan on bringing that same cargo vehicle right back to Earth instead of landing in the water. They want to bring it right back to land.
How many of the Dragons have returned by the means you just mentioned? Heat shield, parachute, landing in the ocean. How many have done that? And was every one of them on the return successful?
Yeah, SpaceX is good at that. They're up to 10. And then there was a test one before that, so I guess that would be 11. That NASA didn't get charged for. They only did like, you know, a couple hundred pounds, I think 1,000 pounds or something. But, yeah, so there's really like 10 contracted missions. They're $2.5 billion collectively, you know, for the first, I think it was 10 flights. And then now they've added to that another couple of $1 billion more of these flights for the next 4 or 5 years. So that's one company that will be doing it. The other company in the future will be SNC, Sierra Nevada Corporation. They'll be sending up Dream Chaser. And that'll go up with cargo, and we'll bring cargo back, and instead of coming back on parachute and landing in the water or propulsive landing and landing on land, it's going to come back with wings and land on a runway. And that will probably, the earliest flight would be the end of 2019. Back to the WS-1.
So Dragons bring up something like 6,000 pounds of consumables or hardware, payloads, bring a good number of 1,000 pounds back home. 10 or 11 times they've done that. So of every one of the Dragons that got to the International Space Station, they all came back home safely. Did every one of the attempted launch of Dragon get to the space station? Were there any failures on the upgoing mission, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, number 7 blew up. You know, it got up to, you know, maybe 2 minutes into flight, almost 2 minutes, and the whole thing blew up. And with it, it took, naturally, all the supplies that was going to the space station. But most importantly, it took the ITER, the International Docking Data, the first one that was supposed to be installed. And where that goes is the end of the PMA, pressure mating adapter, number 2. So the one that was just relocated is number 3. ITER didn't make it. But since then, SpaceX brought up another rebuilt, brand new ITER, built by Boeing, and installed onto PMA. So they have the one docking system complete, and what they're doing now is, you know, when I spoke about the EVA, that's the second docking port. PMA 3, pressure mating adapter 3, is now attached. That will need a new international docking adapter as well on the end of that before spacecraft can dock with that. And when it's ones that will be docked are going to be Starliner by Boeing and a crewed Dragon with people, very similar to what's going on there with cargo. We'll have people, not the same thing, but, you know, one equipped with a life support system. Back to you, Dick.
Impressive. SpaceX has done a number of re-landings of a booster, like this last booster they used this week was used, I think, 6 months or so ago, got refurbished and reused, so it made a second launch. And yes, it's safer to launch, to land it on a barge out in the ocean. And maybe in some cases, if the boosting goes so far downrange that it's not easily to return all the way to Cape Canaveral, so it has to land on a barge out in the ocean. But as he gets better and better with these recovering of the boosters, does he eventually intend to land many of them all the way back at Cape Kennedy or Cape Canaveral, WS2N, K2RIW? And has he landed one at Cape Canaveral already?
Yeah, he's done three at Cape Canaveral. Two at night, one in the daytime. But the daytime one was a cloudy day. I'm waiting for a nice clear day. That should look great. But yeah, successfully, he lands him at Launch Complex. It used to be called Launch Complex 13. He used to launch Atlas rockets out of there. He took over that launch complex, did away with everything, put a 300-foot diameter concrete landing pad, put a big X, well, that's his logo, you know, SpaceX, put a big X in the middle, and three times successfully, these rockets have come down and landed almost dead center. So, yeah, that's great, no barge needed. But that's on flights where, you know, you need to have enough fuel to come back all the way to Cape Canaveral. These other flights, sending our spacecraft to geosynchronous orbit, need a lot more power, a lot more fuel is used, and you know, they don't have that capability. So yeah, they have to land it on a barge 450 miles off the coast of Florida.
I have the impression that in the case of a three-stage rocket, maybe what's going to synchronous orbit, geosynchronous orbit, is three stages. Does he intend to recover not only the first stage of boosting, but also the second stage of boosting of UFO, Q2RAW?
Yeah, it's really, you know, as far as SpaceX is concerned, it's really a two-stage rocket. The big satellite that gets put into geosynchronous orbit, yeah, it has its own thrusters on board too, but it's not by SpaceX, and that finishes off the orbit getting into where it's got to go. And sometimes they're ion drives, so if it's chemical drives, they can get to orbit within a week or so to start operation. If it's ion drives, it takes maybe 2, 3, 4, 5 months, I've heard. Long time to get where they got, where they have to go. That's up to the satellite provider. SpaceX has two boosters they're worried about. The 9 Merlin 1D engines that they have attached to the first booster. They're doing very good at bringing those things back successfully now 9 times. They've landed them. The second stage consists of a Merlin 1D engine also. You know, same thing that you have in a booster, the main booster. And the only difference is it's got like a longer bell-shaped cone coming out of the back. It's better for impulse. It's really basically the same kind of engine, so it keeps the course down for the second stage. And will that come back? I was saying that earlier. Right now, every one of them, standard procedure now. No, you know, if it's United Launch Alliance or Ariane 5 or whatever it is, the final stage has little thrusters on it. They turn around and they tend to deorbit them right away. They don't like to keep these things floating in outer space for a couple of weeks and then come down on a city somewhere. So they deorbit them, they get them into the ocean. But he's planning on deorbiting and trying to save them in the future with a heat shield. I'm not sure exactly how he's going to go about doing it, but probably heat shield, a combination of that and parachute. But yeah, that's one of his goals. And then the only thing that will not be coming back out of the whole rocket, legs all the way up, will be the trunk, and that's attached to the Dragon spacecraft. Back to you, Dick.
Let me break away for a minute and see if Andy is still with us. Andy, N2HUH, are you still with us? I want to find out if he was going to the Northeast Astronomy Forum this coming weekend. this coming Saturday and this coming Sunday at Rockland Community College. I don't know if it's the 10th or the 15th annual, but something like 130 telescope vendors, or vendors of telescope hardware, are going to be there with some very nice lectures. And so it looks like Rich, KTUPS, and I are going to go, and I was wondering if Andy's going to go. One other thing that you should know about is that this coming Friday night at Stony Brook University, the Department of Physics and Astronomy has their astronomy open night starting at 7:30 in the Earth and Space Science Center, right off the quad. Can we drop? It's free of charge, starts at 7:30 and lasts for at least an hour. And if the weather is clear, they go to the roof of the building and use their telescopes. The subject is going to be unveiling of the first moments of the universe's creation with the Simons, S-I-M-O-N-S, Observatory. The Simons Observatory is a microwave telescope constructed at the Atacama Desert in Chile, a $40 million structure. And I think it's a microwave telescope. They've got a millimeter wave telescope there called ALMA, and now this microwave telescope. So we're going to hear the details of those measurements being made in Chile. Will be given by Professor Nelima Sehgal, S-E-H-G-A-L, Sehgal. It's coming Friday night. So for people who are interested in astronomy, and as I said, the price is right, that lecture hall can hold 300 people. So he intends to recover the first and second stage boosters, as I have the impression. Let me drop. In the case of a satellite that's going into geosynchronous orbit, 22,300 miles up, they usually get there, the last stage of boosting is a solid-state thing that's called the apogee kick motor. And I think you're saying they're thinking of substituting the apogee kick motor with an ionic drive. The normal launch to synchronous orbit is you first put something in low Earth orbit, make sure the hardware survives the most rigorous portion of the launch, the big vibrations going through the atmosphere, breaking the sound barrier and so on. And if all's well, then you launch it to the next step into geosynchronous orbit with two more burns in what's called a Holman maneuver. And I think that's done with one or two apogee kick motors. Now, is that going to be done? Is some portion of that boosting for geosynchronous orbit in the future is going to be a lighter thruster that takes a longer time, and it's an ionic engine. So give me a little more details on that. I didn't hear enough of that because I was getting a sandwich. WS2N, K2RIW, the tech man.
WS2N, yeah, they've been doing that for quite a while, actually, quite a few years now. Military's done it, National Reconnaissance Office, the NRO, they've done it with satellites. And some of the ones that have been launched by the Ariane 5 rockets, some of those, sometimes they'll launch two big satellites at one time, that's a big heavy lift vehicle. Some of those have ion drives on them too. So, I guess it's a choice of what the satellite provider wants to do, how soon they want to get to their location. The sooner they get there, the faster they start making money. So that's really all that is. The boost to get you, two and a half minutes of flight, and then that separates them. SpaceX has them coming back to the second stage. Still got the satellite, the bearing comes off after it's actually in space. And you're just flying with the booster and the second stage booster and the satellite for quite a while. They'll shut the booster down, and then maybe half hour later or so, let me drop it. If you watch the SpaceX webcast, roughly about a half hour or so after that, the rocket will